Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the strap on my helmet, it's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Mate, that's another weird intro you've scripted for me there. The strap on my helmet. What the hell?
Well, I try and make it, without giving anything away, I try and make it so it's directed towards or a clue towards our guest, you see. You know, so when we've had chefs on, it might be a food-related thing. But today, strap, helmet, where could we be going?
Well, do you know what? It was so subtle, I didn't make the link. So, anyway, our guest today. Well, do you know what? The word legend is often overused, but in this instance, it is absolutely 100%. He's a pure motorcycling legend, simple as that. And if I could recount as many trophies and records that he's chalked up over his 30-year career, well, we'd be here all bloody night. And actually, I'd rather get talking to the man. It is, of course, the one, the only, Mr. John McGuinness, MBE. John, how are you?
Hey, top man. I appreciate the MBE. Not a lot of people chuck the MBE bit in, but I'm over the moon with that one. But I've never been called a strap on.
Okay.
Not a strap on. Am I a strap on?
I would never be so rude as to refer to you as a strap on, Mr. John McGuinness. But anyway, you're here.
You know what, lads? I'm absolutely over the moon. Happy. Happy as Larry. New deal with Honda. New set of teeth. Everybody's happy. Family's safe. I'm in a good place. I'm in a really, really good place
good,
at the minute.
Good.
Mate, tell us about the deal, because obviously, I mean, we saw that. It's fresh off the press, maybe a couple of weeks old, if that. Go on, explain, because, you know, I thought I think he's hung his helmet. Woof! No, he hasn't. Talk me through it.
Well, it might be a long story, this, but I'll try and make it interesting to listen to. Obviously, I have a long relationship with Honda from 1998, to 2002, then from 2006 to 2017. Then I had a huge accident at the Northwest 200. Right. Broke my tib and my fib and I lost 52 millimetres of my leg, which I had to grow back. It was a rough time, you know, and I went on doing other things. I went to ride for Norton, which was disastrous. And then, you know, COVID come along and one thing another. And just while all the COVID was on, my old Honda bosses were nibbling in my ear, just quietly away, you know, how's it going, how's the family, you know, we've got some ideas for TT 2022, you know, I was just about to turn 50 year old, it's my 100th start, it's the 30th anniversary of the Fireblade, so, you know, all sort of the planets lined up,
yeah.
And, you know, they offered me a package there and a deal, and, you know, it felt right, it's like sort of putting the old slippers back on, if you like. You know. We had a lot of success with Honda, and when I had my bump, we went in our different directions. And to be fair, it was sort of like getting divorced, but not really wanting to get divorced, if you like. And we split up a bit, and we've got back together again, and we've gone over to give each other a hug and a kiss, and you know, we've scribbled on the dotted line, and it's, you know, there's some other options there. If I race, I race. If I don't race, it's not a problem. But we can do some ambassador stuff for Honda, you know. I can stand at the bar all night and talk to the journalists, you know, with a gin and tonic in my hand and tell everybody how great I used to be. And, you know, and there's not a lot of riders around who can actually come up with this tale.
Well, do you know what, mate? It's gone down an absolute storm, has it? I mean, everybody from all walks of motorsport, whether it be cars or bikes or, you know, off-road or speedway, it doesn't matter what it is, everyone's just really chuffed to bits for you. It's brilliant news.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I hope so. It was a bit, let's say, it's... Sometimes I get a little bit embarrassed about it because, you know, 50-year-old bit, you know, middle-aged spread going on.
And, mate, there's nothing wrong with that.
I know, you're the same. You're my inspiration, mate. I tell you, if you pack in, I'm packing now. I love you. Well, you're not packing in here, are you?
No. But I'll be at the bar with you, though, mate. Telling stories about how great you were.
Yeah, when I heard the story about standing at the bar with the G&T, I thought, well, I know somebody else who's just like that as well, so I can picture the two of you together. So, in a way, I suppose, John, this is just a really nice full stop to what has been a pretty tricky and horrible couple of years for everybody, you know, yourself included, what with COVID and whatnot.
Exactly. You know, it's weird because I could have sat on my backside and done nothing, but I did that Ducati Cup for the last couple of years, and we ran the team from our home, You know, the wife was involved, that my son Ewan, he's just turning 20-year-old, so he was involved. And, you know, all the time when I was riding the Ducati Cup, I was keeping sharp, I was keeping riding, keeping everything alert, keeping all the muscles up to speed. Mm-hmm. And always in the back of my mind, I was thinking, well, I need to keep sharp because, you know, I know what's going to be coming when it does come. We're going to be going down Braille at the TT. So, yeah. But yeah, it's a nice thing. The bike's good. The team's good. It's a lot of the right people and mechanics and staff that I've worked with before, PR girls and everything else. So it just feels right. But it was tough, you know, riding for that Norton, and, you know, they went bang and they owed me a few quid. And, you know, I don't want to go into details, but, you know, I never look great in a chrome suit. Anyway, I always look like a... I always look like a fat chicken in tinfoil, but you know, to be, I've done 52,000 miles around the Isle of Man TT wow. track. So that's twice around the world.
Say that again.
About 52,000 miles, about twice around the world.
What, in about an hour?
Well, yeah, maybe on the computer. But no, it was funny. It was when I had my cage on my leg, we were working it out because Valentino Rossi. Bless him, you know, he's retired now, what a legend. He was putting a piece in the press that he'd been around the world doing MotoGP racing. So I sat down with my lad, I thought, be interesting how many...
37.34 miles.
So I worked it out, I'd been around the world twice, so I was like, wow. stuck the finger up at Rossi.
Mate, that is incredible, isn't it?
That is incredible.
Mm. Mate, can I just wax lyrically here and just tell a lovely little story that... When was it we went down, John? Was it 2019 we went down to watch the last round of MotoGP at Valencia? All the lads went down. Was it 19 or 18?
I thought it was maybe a bit before that, maybe.
Anyway.
What a trip that was, wasn't it?
Oh, wasn't it? Great. I mean, you know, there's some really good guys on this trip. Very, very well known. I won't say who they were, but some proper guys. Anyway, we got great tickets. And I've only come across Rossi, obviously, on the TV, but in person, maybe three times in my life, and we had access to his garage, and we walked in there, and I did what most of us did, which was just kind of stand still and a little bit, you know, starstruck, really. And then there was this moment where John walked in behind us as part of our group, and Rossi just dropped what he was doing, ran over, and man, that's an amazing thing to see. You are so, what's the word? Humble?
Well, yeah, maybe. It's a good thing to be, isn't it? You know, yeah. I haven't really changed. You know, I'm a northerner. I was sort of brought up on a council estate in Esham, and I'm still grounded and still got my same friends, still live in the same area. And but no, with Rossi, I mean, you know, he came to the Isle of Man TT in 2009 with Agostini, and he did a lap of the TT track. And when he came, it was brilliant. You know, for somebody like Valentino to come and praise us, he called us gods. You know, he called us, you know, I can't remember what he said now, but it was basically just respect. We're like gladiators, that's what he said. And yeah. for somebody like Rossi to come, and it would have been so tarnishing for us, because everybody listens to him, he's such a role model. If he come across and said, you know, what a bunch of lunatics they are, you know, God say they're on a death wish and all that lot, which some people do think that, you know, but Rossi really understood it. He really got it, and we've been friends ever since. You know, he calls me Steel Balls. Steel Balls.
You must have trouble through the metal detector, don't you, on the airport? I would imagine.
I've had a set of dangly steel balls. Yeah, I'd be struggling, but yeah, I've got a bit of steel work in me. But yeah, not that I wanted it, but I've got some unwanted screws in my body. Yeah, but and Valentino, you know, I've been a long-term Monster Energy athlete as well, and it was Valentino sort of got me the deal in 2009, because I got the money shot with him giving me the, so I won the Formula One race and he gave me the trophy, and I said to Monster, I said, look, pay me if you think I'm worth it. If you don't think I'm worth it, don't worry about it. And I had my Monster hat on, and Rossi was handing me the trophy, and I thought, there's your money shot, Monster. So I've been with him ever since. But you know, we keep in touch, we have a bit of a yarn on the telephone. And you know, it's nice that he actually understands I call it the crack. I don't know if you guys call it the crack, but you know, he gets the crack, and we have a bit of banter, send a few daft jokes and stuff. And he's invited me across to his place a few times. I've not managed to get there to that. He had that 100-kilometer race, because he has his ranch, doesn't he? So I'd love to get to his ranch, but and he's 42. And he smoked them all. He won that the 100-kilometer race. He smoked them all.
Did he really?
You know, all the all the young MotoGP riders, Moto2 riders, Moto3 riders. He just showing them all. You know, he handed their asses to them and won.
So casting the mind back, where did it all begin? Because your dad was your dad did a bit of racing, yeah.
He did, yeah. My dad, we had a bike shop and in Morecambe, McGuinness Motorcycles it was, and. My dad was, I looked up to my dad, he was mint, you know, he was the typical bike dealer, car dealer, bit Arthur Daly, bit of a boy, you know. And he didn't really have a dealership, I called it a lock-up, but it was like...
Bike shops were like that though, weren't they though?
Yeah, they were lock-ups, weren't they?
Yeah, they weren't as grand as car garages, were they? They were like a sort of lock-up.
That's right, you know, big wooden doors, I can remember it so well, and... You know, he'd be servicing a bike or, selling something, or there'd be scooters, be some racing bikes in there. And, you know, I had a little Italia Jet 50 and, you know, my dad just started it up and said, right, son, get yourself away on that. And I was only 4 years old and I used to just rip round an industrial estate in Morecambe and nobody bothered. You know, all the other people in the garages and, you know, there were machine shops and joiner shops and it was just the norm to see me hurtling around the estate on my bike, you know. I mean, nowadays, the police helicopter would be up, wouldn't it? And like a bike would be crushed and you just, you get a black mark by your name. But, he brought me up and my dad did a bit of racing. My dad was pretty good, you know. He was all right, my dad, but he was always one of them, you know, if he'd have a TZ750 and somebody had bid him a bit of profit so he'd sell it and he'd have an RG500 and somebody, you know, I remember his RG500, he swapped it for a CB400, a Cortina estate and a sheepdog, so... That was it.
What a deal.
I remember him turning up and the dog was in the back of it because it was an estate car, so it was a Cortina estate, so the dog was just looking out the back window. And I wanted to keep the dog, but my dad had sold the dog as well, so that was the end of that. But my dad was just never quite dedicated himself, if that's the word, you know. He was always, he were always drinking, he were always shagging, and he was always fighting, so, you know, the combination didn't really work, but...
So by contrast then, I mean, obviously, you've been brought up and surrounded by bikes because of what your dad did, but at what point did you think, this is going to be my single-minded focus? I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this to the absolute best of my ability.
Well, do you know what? I went across to the Isle of Man TT for the first time when I was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was actually racing. He was racing in an event called the Jerby Road Races, which was on the Isle of Man, a little short race there. And it was when TT practice was on. So I'm 10 years old. You know, we go out to watch the TT practice for the first time. He sticks my head through one of the barriers at the bottom of Bray Hill.
Yeah.
I seen all these people come down. You know, it was Joey Dunlop, Mick Grant, Graham Crosby, Ron Haslam, all these legends. I was like, whoa.
Wow.
Yeah, what is this? And just the noise, the smell, the speed, and it just sort of ignited something in my head there and then when I was 10 years old. But you know, it's like when you're 10, you're off, you're at school, you're doing a bit of schoolboy motocross riding, and you know, I got a bike when I was 16. I had a Suzuki AP50, used to go to school on that. That was always good for a bit of pulling the birds at the back of the bike shed. You know, if you had a bike, you were quite cool, weren't you? I turned 17, I got a TZR125 on the road, a Yamaha, then... I had a KR1S Kawasaki that was actually my dad's, and I sort of, when I passed my test, I sort of pinched it off him, if you like. And but at that point, I'm going around 120 mile an hour around our streets, around our roads. We know we're not too far off the Lake District, so we've got some great roads.
And,
but while all this is going on, my dad's getting some reports back that, you know, some of the older lads, older generation are going, you know, get this lad off the road, he's going to kill himself. And, you know, when you're 17, you don't respect it, do you? You know, you're just hurtling around everywhere. And thank God, really, them guys sort of said what they said to my dad. And I remember my dad saying, you know, all right, yeah, come on, let's go and do some racing. You think you're fast enough. And off we went to a racetrack at Aintree in Liverpool. And, finished 29th and 31st. I thought, ooh.
Got some graft to do.
Yeah, it's not just quite as easy as it looks, this racing. I got my pants pulled down, off we went home, you know. But, yeah, that was my first race, 1990. But you never know, do you? When you're 17, 18, I never had anything. I never, you know, my mum was chucking a few quid in, my nana was chucking a few quid in. I was apprentice bricklayer at the time, so I was sticking my little bit in. And, you know, there was family and friends and, You know, somebody buy a tyre, somebody buy a chain, somebody pay for an entry. And,
wow.
You know, my vehicle van, it was, there were no insurance, no tax, no MOT. It was full of red diesel. Windscreen wipers didn't windscreen wipers didn't work. It was just a, you know, it was an absolute expedition getting to the race before we even started. But all I wanted to do was be a professional bike racer. You know, I hadn't started with anything and lost it all. I had nothing to start with, so everything I got was a bonus, you know.
Yeah.
And was the Isle of Man sort of mecca for you then in that respect? Is that ultimately where, from being 10 years old and going over there and seeing your dad race, was that where you kind of thought, ultimately, I want to end up back here?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But it's, I always think, you know, when you're 18, 19, 20, 21, you're just too young. You know, you need to go away and you need to grow up and you need to understand how hard the ground is, you know.
Because you were 24, wait, is that right? 24 when you did your first DT?
24. I might have just turned 25, yeah, right, 1996. Yeah. So I'd been away and done some club racing. I'd done some club championships, if you like. Things were tough, you know. I was still struggling a little bit financially and struggling for budget to run the bikes, but I never give in, you know. A lot of my mates were, it's funny, they were off, they'd found out what beer did and, you know, the funny little tablets did in these acid parties and, you know, raves and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, my mates were like, oh, we're off to, you know, Wigan Pier this weekend, are you coming? I'm like, no, I'm off to Cadwell. And they all thought I was nuts, you know.
Yeah.
So I just kept, I had a dream, you know, really. Yeah. It was a bit, I didn't want to come off that, and I didn't want anybody to tell me, you know. I was laying bricks as a trade. I hated that job. You know, the guy who said to me, you're just a bricky getting that hole. And it used to motivate me, it used to drive me, it used to go around the track thinking, sure, you bastard. But
do you know what? How powerful was that sticking your head through the fence at the bottom of Bray Hill, eh? All those years ago.
Which is where my Uncle Malcolm lives, funnily enough.
No.
He's literally the last left down the bottom of Bray Hill, John, just before you get to Quarterbridge.
You shouldn't have said that. We'll be having an hospitality suite. All the lads will be in there.
You can never get near it during TT week because he does what a lot of people do, B&B, and he'll have, like, you know, 12 Dutch bikers or whatever sleeping on the floor and people from Germany and people from wherever, you know, and they make their money then, and actually it pays for their holiday in the summer.
That's perfect. That's the Isle of Man for you in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah,
people
absolutely.
Just open the doors, open the garages. And I remember a couple of years ago, there was a freak storm and everybody's tents were wrecked and everybody was drenched. So all the residents just opened the garages up and let them use all the dryers and stuff like that. Mm. You know, it's such a friendly place. It's amazing, really. It's like proper little rough diamond, isn't it, in the middle of the Irish Sea. I mean, I'd love to get hold of the guy who decided in 1907 they were going to have a race.
Yeah.
I'd love to have a word with him now and realise what he's actually done.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you. You know, you're best known obviously for your TT success, but you've had a success on tracks all around the world. But is there a marked difference between the nerves that you feel when you're about to start at Cadwell or Alton Park or Donington or somewhere like that, compared to when you're about to start the TT, just because of the relative difference in danger?
Top question.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, it's still the same now, you know, coming up to my 100th start. Even now, when you just mentioned it, I can feel the hairs on the back of my neck going up, and I'm thinking, oh my God, what we're just about to embark on here. And, you know, I do get nervous with every racing I do get nervous. You know, I've done World Endurance, done some 500 Grand Prix, I've done Macau GP, I've done lots of racing, but there's nothing like just looking down Bray Hill, and it's, you know, the worst thing is it's the noise of a helicopter as well. You know, the helicopters leave and they're the medical helicopters, and when the medical helicopters go, you're like, we're not far away from start.
Yeah.
And the TV helicopters above you, and it's just that I always, like, my son's old enough now to probably understand, you know, and it's that awkward dad hug you have to have.
Yeah.
And I have to, my daughter's 11 now, but last time she was TT, she'd be 9 or something. So I have to make sure I just clock her eyes before I go.
Yeah.
And then you sort of go into a holding pen, sort of where the mechanics have done their bit and they leave you, and you pedal down with your feet down with the bike engine running. So the bike's just like, bum, 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 underneath you. And you're walking towards the old boy who gives you a tap on the shoulder.
I was going to say, how about the tap on the shoulder? Does that register?
Yeah, you know, he's got a grip of your shoulder. And then that last sort of, I've set off number one a few times, so it's quite sometimes even more pressure, but I quite like it, number one. I quite like to be clear track in front of me, you know, but, and then that last few second or so, you're just concentrating on, it's normally a dignitary who's, who starts the race as well, drops the flag for you the first time. I remember a few years ago, that Toto Wolff was there. And about 30 seconds before the race, I'm like that, waving at him. he dropped the flag and off we went. I saw him after the race. He says, oh, why did you not look where you're going? And I said, oh, no, it's just what we're like, us lads. I'll just sort of give you a wave just before you start the race. And I think he was crapping his own more than me. But going back to, it is unbelievably, and it's not fun. I have to say, I don't particularly enjoy that bit.
But even like the bit there that you referenced before, in terms of glancing at your kids and whatnot, at the risk of, I don't want to make it too dark, but there must genuinely be, and I think you've sort of said it indirectly, that there is a thought where you're thinking, I might not see them again.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's no sugarcoating it. Yeah, I'm looking across thinking, you know, hot. And I say it to myself, geez, I hope that's not the last time I see him. And I have some sort of odd superstitions as well. You know, I always drop a lucky penny down my leathers.
Do you?
Wow. From 2004, Ewan, my son, he found a penny for me, and he said, oh, you know, there's a penny for luck. And it just freaked me out a bit. I thought, well, it's going to have to come with me for the race, this. And
lovely.
I dropped it down my front of my leathers. And it's weird, that penny, she'll drop it down the front of my leathers, and sometimes it ends up in my arse crack, it ends up all over the place.
In your sock, presumably?
In my socks, in my back, on my backside. The amount of imprints I've had of Her Majesty on my body over the years. But, I tell you what, anything that'll look after you around there, I'll take it.
Absolutely. And so connected to that, John, you've got 23 TT race wins, if my maths are correct, right? Three away from equaling Joey Dunlop's record of 26. Do you think, and this is related to the conversation that we're having and have just had, if you're being completely honest, will you ever be ready to call it a day while there is still a chance of equaling or indeed breaking that record?
Oh, honestly, it's a question I get asked a lot, and it's a question I'd like to be able to answer that would make any sense, really. But my honest answer, I would say, would be yes, I would be. I would be ready to hang my boots up if I haven't surpassed Joey or matched Joey. I think the icing on the cake would be to match him. I think with my hand on my heart, at 50-year-old, it's going to be very, very difficult.
The pandemic's cost you two vital years as well, hasn't it? You know, and I think for anybody in any sport where age becomes critical, you must be kicking yourself thinking, do you know what, that was two more bloody years that I could have made up those missing three wins.
Yeah, do you know what, it is, you're right, 100%, but do you know what, I am absolutely so, so happy and so pleased with what I've achieved over the last 20-odd years. I'm not really chasing anything anymore, you know. I genuinely love riding motorbikes. I genuinely love the Isle of Man as a place. There's no real gun to my head anymore, you know. I don't really have to stick my neck out, you know. All I want to do is go to the Isle of Man and do the best I can. Yeah. And, you know, there was a lot of pressure on my shoulders a lot of years ago. 2007's that centenary year, 2000, you know, first 130. And I used to really, really pressure myself up, and I was hell-bent to win, you know. And I had to win in a lot of ways because they expected that. Mm. But now I'm in a real nice position where I can... You know, I don't have to win, but the competitiveness in me as well. I always think, I try and dissect it all. I scribble stuff down. I must be mad, but I'm thinking, oh, I might have a chance here because, you know, we've had no TT for 2 years and I'm the most experienced rider. And, you know, if we get a little bit of bad weather on Tuesday, Wednesday, nobody gets any track time. And when the race comes, I might be in the hot seat. So, you know, I still have that desire and the push to do it, but I ain't sticking my neck out anymore.
Well, do you know what, that was going to bring me on to a question, actually. I can imagine that the TT being the sort of event it is, John, that actually, you know, experience and knowledge and knowing every millimetre of that road like you do, actually that must count for a lot, eh?
It does. I think it does, yeah. I think it does, but again, I have to be really careful as well, because I have to still respect it.
Yeah,
you know, that place to me is it's like a living thing somehow. I don't know. I just treat it like it's like a, it's like some sort of mother god, you know. don't disrespect the place.
Within a split second, though, it'll eat you.
100%, yeah. And do you know what? It's scary now. You know, I'm probably going off on the tangents a bit, but the bikes are scary. I mean...
What quick scary, you mean? Because yeah, they're so quick.
Honestly, Jason, you can't get your breath on them, you know. I mean, wow. from point... Say a little bit to the track. I say point A to B, you know, you're just firing the bike off the start line to Quarter Bridge, and then you Quarter Bridge to Braddon Bridge to... And they're just... They are so, so fast. But a lot of things haven't changed. You know, swing arm positions, engine positions, frame and all that. Geometry's the same, but they're just...
Is it really? Wow.
They are, yeah, but they just have... The tyres are better, and they bloody just have loads and loads of power. They're 200... There'll be 225 horsepower. And they weigh 165 kilos, so you know you can't get your breath on them at times. But
and you're on slicks, aren't you?
Slicks on the super bike. You're on a lightly treaded tyre on the super stock bike and super sport bike. When I raced the electric bikes, they were on slicks.
Hey, what was that like, actually?
Yeah, good.
Was that a bit odd having that? You know, having no auditory, no noise. It's like a sense, isn't it? You know, when you've got an engine and when that's taken away, I bet that's an odd experience, eh?
That, do you know what? It's a simple word, but you know that word you just said, odd. That's exactly what it is.
Is it?
Odd. Yeah. But not odd in a bad way. It's just odd, different, you know. Yeah, odd, yeah. You know, you can hear the wind whistling. You can hear the chain going around. You can hear the brakes humming.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I mean, they just weigh a ton. They're 260 kilos, but they're absolutely planted, you know, over the bumps and everything else. They're really, really bumpy. Wow. But at low speed, they're quite clumsy and quite... quite hard to turn, but do you know what? I worked with Mr. Honda himself, Hiratoshi Honda, which was Hiratoshi, which is Sashira's son, the original founder.
Yeah,
and they trekked me so well. Wow. I enjoyed every single minute of it, and they were so dedicated and focused on that machine. And we went from doing 102 mile an hour average to 122. Christ. In 2019, and I did 176 through the speed trap down the end of Silver Straight. And I was going down it. It's like it hasn't got. It's endless, you know. It was just spinning and spinning, and it felt like it would do 500 mile an hour. It didn't. You know, you drive a piston engine car, and it revs, and the torque drop, and they change, and you know, and you got to keep it in a range. That thing just went and went, no gears.
Yeah, it felt like there was no end to it.
Yeah, and you know, me and you are old school, Jason, and that when they brought that bike to the TT in 2012, you know, some of the older generation were like, you know, like, look at that thing, you know, this will never take off. But in 2019, the last TT, you know, they're embracing it a little bit and dead proud of what we've achieved, because a lot of that technology has definitely gone into the new, well, the Northern Motor's gone into the new electric motocross bike that Honda are making for the next couple of years.
Even in the last couple of years, though, what with the pandemic and the way that the world has stopped, and as you say, you just reminded us that the last TT was 2019, I would imagine that technology has come on, you know, in terms of batteries and the whole, and we can see it with electric cars for sure, and it must be the same with bikes.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. The more power, the more electronics. There's a new model Kawasaki, there's a new model Honda out, there's a new model BMW. And to be fair, at the back of my mind, it worries me a little bit, because we're going into sort of unknown territory, you know. Some of the bikes now, I think, are a little bit too highly strung, you know. A lot of the times they don't need to have that much power, and they don't need to have that much RPM. And if the bikes...
Petrol bikes here, or electric?
Yeah, petrol bikes. The electric bike job's fallen away a little bit. There's nobody to challenge the Mugen people. I just wish one of the other manufacturers would get involved. But the big bikes, you know, if the bikes, they're revving to 16,500, well, it's nuts, you know. There's a lot of components flying around.
Moving around,
And if they rev to 15 and they were safe, the racing would still be the same. So it does worry me a little bit. So we are going into... But you watch now, as long as my arse points to the ground, you watch that first night in practice, they'll be flat out. They'll be absolutely flat out. You know, there's Hickeys and the Harrisons and the Connors, and all, they'll just be absolutely dialed and focused and on the pipe straight away.
Is it still 16.42, Peter Hickman's record, is that right?
1642, yeah. Yeah, don't remind me.
Well, no. I'm just curious because, again, no, but I mean, you know, we know it's fast. I spend my whole life, John, getting stuck down a rabbit hole watching onboard TT videos. Yeah. And I try and look for something else. And then before you know it, an hour and a half.
Dave, I'm interrupting, mate, same here. I just cannot catch my breath. When you sit and watch it. It's insane, isn't it?
There's times when I've been around the island three times and I wasn't even supposed to be doing that. But anyway, and you actually look at it, right? We're now talking about, for round figures, averaging more than 130 miles per hour on that 37¾-mile course, right? 17 minutes, just under 17 minutes. What goes through, and this might be a stupid question, but I can only relate it to the fact that if I'm driving a car, I'll daydream, right? And I'll be thinking about something else. And I might have done 10 miles on the motorway and I don't remember doing this. Now, the risk of asking a stupid question, for somebody who has done the TT that many times, is there ever times when you're on a lap where actually you're just sort of on autopilot?
Good question, that. Good question, yeah. Never been said that autopilot. Yeah, I would say.
But you know what I mean?
Yes.
Where you're not. You know when you're literally hanging on for grim death, and you can remember every single millisecond. But then there must be other stretches where you kind of go, "I'm just sort of doing it," and I'm thinking about what I'm having for tea.
Yeah, you do. 100%. Yeah, you get into rhythms and cycles and bits where you've got to work really, really hard. Mm. Somewhere where you've got to really work to change direction on the bike. Some of the bumpy sections, but you have to. Make sure that you take deep breaths as well. A lot of riders, when they ride around there, they hold the breath, you know, and they're like, and they're grabbing hold of the bars really, really tight, and then they get arm pump and they get more fatigued and then they get vulnerable. But, you know, it's like doing a dot to dot. It's like, you know, to one to two to, or a C to D to F, you know, you just got to be one step ahead of it all the time, you know. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, when you watch it, you can't compute it because you don't know what's coming up. For me, I know exactly where I am. I know exactly what gear I'm in. I know exactly the tipping points. But
because you know it so well and your eyes are so far up the road, rather than looking at markers and references, would I be right in thinking, and maybe I'm wrong, but the way I look at bits of road that I know, I don't ever look at anything off the road. I just kind of feel where I'm going. Mm. Would you say that's right for you? You're right. I'm in here now, and I'm rather than looking for little references, would that be right?
You do.
Or wrong?
Yeah, exactly right, Jason, mate. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what you do.
You feel it.
It's like I go around sometimes and go, "Where do you break?" And I go, "I don't know." And I actually genuinely mean that. I'm not trying to hide any information. Mm. It's a feel thing. It's an engine note thing and an RP, and it's wind as well. Because, you know, short circuits, you might average 70, 80, 90 mile an hour, that you're averaging 130 plus. So it's you can actually feel where you are with the wind. It's those bits that catch you out where that you can't educate anybody with. You know, if the wind's changed direction 90 degrees and you get blown off the track on the mountain or something like that.
Mm.
But because, like I say, I've done so many laps, I know I can feel from the bottom bit of the track where the wind's going to come from on the mountain. So I know
can
whether
you?
To... Yeah, I know whether to peel in a little bit earlier or peel in a little bit later on some of the corners up on the mountain.
So tell me, the pit stops.
Yeah.
What's going through your head there? Are you processing what's happened or what's coming?
Probably. I have to take a little bit of a back step and let the boys do what they're doing. You know, the bikes are stationary for about 45 seconds because you need 24 litres of fuel in. Need a rear tyre, and then just a general look round the bike, and also a tear-off, another visor with two tear-offs on, because it's really bad for flies. But, you know, sometimes I want information, sometimes I'm not bothered, and sometimes I'll just sit and chill and have a drink of water and let them boys do it. But it's a blur. You know, like I say, it's 40 seconds, just in, you think, what, I'm out again. You're not getting much of a rest. And we've had some fantastic pit stops over the years, but... It is weird. Our Fireblade Honda from 2008 right through to 2016 was a very economical bike. So all you're doing is filling your tank back up. But if you've used 2 litres less than the BMWs or the Suzukis or the Kawasakis, then it's 1.2. Yeah, it's 1.2.
Time in the bag, isn't it?
course it is, yeah. And people are like, oh, you were fast in the pits. I'm like, oh, yeah, I just keep nodding because we don't realise we're using less fuel.
So which leads me on to, sorry to interrupt, leads me on to another question. If during the lap you're getting little markers off your pit boards at various points around, if you're saying the lead, you know, you got a healthy lead, are you still flat out? You're thinking, hold on, I could save a bit of juice here, which will then gain me another 1 or 2 seconds in the stop. Are you thinking like that, or are you just flat?
You're not flat out. If you've got a good lead, if you've got a good buffer, well, to be fair, you have and you haven't, you know, until you've done your final pit stop. It can all go wrong in the pit, so if you're 25, 30 second lead and you don't get the back wheel in, all goes wrong in your second pit stop, you've got a lot of work to do and it can be quite difficult. And, I got a 30 second speeding in the pits in 2013, proper rookie knobhead thing to do. I was speeding in the pits and I had to fight my way back onto the podium. But the... I have to say it's an amazing feeling. It's and not many people in the world get to do it, but to have a 25, 30 second lead on that six, you know, you are obviously you're only human and you're a racer and you're listening to everything. You're like, oh, was that a rattle? is the temperature going up? And you know, I try to give myself another couple of. Maybe another foot from the curbs, just so you know that's where you might pick a puncher up. You know, if you're going to pick a puncher up, you're going to pick it up in a curb or something, a nail dropped off a van or something, because it is a public road. So, but it's, you know, I break a little bit early, but 100% concentration to the end. But if there comes a time where I'm feeling it isn't for me on that day, I will be the one to
get out
to roll out of it. Yeah, but I mean, I've been fifth and sixth and eighth and fifth and fourth, and you know, I've had 47 podiums And they've all been amazing,
which is astonishing when you think about it.
It is
isn't
ridiculous,
it? I mean,
isn't it? You know, it's amazing.
Absolutely, 23 senior wins is an incredible record, but 47 podiums.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
That's the most podiums, but I know I'm blowing wind up my ass a bit, but like,
yeah, but
you know,
it's a great ass, and the wind is welcome. Let me tell you.
But I respect everybody that has done a TT. You know, if you're doing 110 mile an hour averages, you're not hanging about, and you know, you have to get an international license, you have to go through all the rigmarole, you have to qualify for the TT to even get on the grid. And if you've done that, then respect to you, because there's plenty of people stand at the bar telling you know, telling you what they're going to do and what they're not going to do, full of shit half of them. So but you know, it's been epic. You know, it's been unreal. I just sat there then looking around in my office, and some of the pictures, you know, I've ridden 1252 strokes, I've ridden 252 strokes of single cylinders, I won the last two 400 TTs, won a couple of electric bike TTs, you know, won 5 TTs on Yamahas, and I rode for Triumph there in 2003, I rode for Ducati there in 2003. Where's it gone? I want to live it all again. I want to go through it all.
Jason, do you know what? I was going to say, normally on Fueling Around, on this podcast, we normally ask people about their car history and what it was like passing their tests and whatever. And do you know what? I don't care.
No,
I really
neither.
Don't care.
Me
because
neither.
I think to have actually had the opportunity, John, to sit down with you for however long we've been gassing just now and actually go through the mental side of doing the TT and what goes through your head and just living and breathing
What a treat.
What, you know, something that we love to watch has been incredible.
You all need to go, though. You all need to go. That Plato has been making loads of noises for the last God knows how many years, but come on.
I've got the crew. We're coming.
This could be my last Gold Cup, so come on. I'm not saying it is, but it could be. So you make sure you're there, mate.
I'll ring my Uncle Malcolm and Auntie Lynn, and it'll be me and then 11 Dutch bikers on the floor.
Oh, we drink your Angie Boom, yeah? Sexy times.
tea, coffee, jammy dodgers, swilled down by gin and tonic.
And on that note, Jason, I think you need to take us out, mate.
Oh, mate, it's a struggle for me to even get the words out. So anyway, that's it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your car, your home insurance, or even your motorbike. Thanks to you, Dave, as always, and a huge thanks to our really special guest this week, the one and only Mr. John McGuinness, MBE.
Pleasure.
Superb. Love that. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plater or at David Vitti. And if you've liked what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button, and share the podcast on all your socials.
What a dude. What a dude. Anyway, guys and girls, look, thanks for listening. And, well, I'm going to go for a cold shower. We'll see you next week. Ta-da!